Let's go. Hi, good evening, everybody. Welcome back. Tonight is December 23rd, and tonight this is the sixth in the series of the French Revolution, the era of the French Revolution. We started last week. Last week we discussed the events leading up to Napoleon Sanhedrin, which was just such a remarkable like event happening. And it was just like something that, to imagine that there was such a Sanhedrin is just an amazing thing. Now, it had really not too many similarities to the real Sanhedrin. And the purpose of the Sanhedrin for Napoleon was to give it publicity, to make it like, to give some credence and authenticity to it. I don't really think he knew the inner workings of the Jewish world, but once he knew there was a Sanhedrin, he went with it. So what we mentioned last time, how did this all come about? From the Battle of Austerlitz, he went through Strasbourg, and there the Goyim were complaining to him about the Jews. Most of the Jews in his empire lived in or about Strasbourg, and that's where his Jews lived, mostly in eastern France, which was very close to western Germany, which was part of the Ashkenazi community. There were not that many Jews in France because France for the past France had thrown all their Jews out in the 1200s. So yeah, the Jews really never worked their way back. There were in the West there were Spanish Jews, Anusim, that they made their way back to France, and there was a few thousand in the West. Assimilated Jews, but most of the Jews in France were in the East, and they were European Jews, and they weren't, comparative to how many Frenchmen there were, I don't even know if they were 0.5% of a population, maybe 0.2, 0.3%, very, very few. So he comes back from Austerlitz, and he's greeted by Frenchmen in that area, and they say the Jews, they're not patriotic. Why they're not patriotic? Because, when France was falling apart with all the revolutions and everything, the Jews, they kept themselves going. They kept it together. They had a shul, they had a rabbi, they had a structure, a communal structure, an infrastructure. And they said, they're not even French. They're a nation unto themselves, which to us is really a compliment. But for the modern era, that's how do you deal with that? Plus, they were also very, very upset they were money lenders, and when you owe money to people, it's not you don't find their best friends.
Well, because weren't allowed to do anything else.
Right. There was very few avenues of business available to the Jews, and that's what they did. Okay, so on his way back, he decided, we got to fix this up. We got to get these Jews into the modern era. And again, just from the little that I read, I really believe that it just seems that Napoleon did it l'shem shemayim. It wasn't like he was doing it to, let's get them all modernized, and then they'll be away from Torah, and then we'll be able to convert them all to Christianity. Other people did have that in mind. Doesn't seem, from what Napoleon is going to do, is that that's what he wanted to do. He just wanted the Jews. Why are you looking like that? Why is everybody, looking down at you? Why are you discriminated against? Maybe if you just got your act together and you were more part of society, that's it. There won't be any discrimination. You'd be able to keep your Torah, do your mitzvahs, but you'll be part of the French, fraternity and liberty and equality.
Was Napoleon arrogant?
Definitely, goes with the job.
Then the idea that I can solve this problem.
Absolutely. Probably
so
he can solve
without
everything.
Without any intention of doing good for the Jews.
Well, he didn't have to get involved with the Jews at all. It was such a small minority. I mean, the fact that he did, okay, he probably had to do with his ego too, but it wasn't that he wanted the Jews to undermine
him.
Right, it's just in his arrogance, he felt he could solve another problem. And, you know, to a large...
Didn't he have a dream about the high priest?
I think that was Alexander the Great. That was a different egotistic maniac that lived in a few hundred. But you should know one of Napoleon's, like, you know, models or his heroes was Alexander the Great.
They even say he
may have decided
to
attack Europe, right? attack Russia and like,
yeah,
right.
Right.
Okay, so after he in order to get this fix this up, he made an assembly of notables, of 110 Jewish notables from different areas from his empire. And at that point, his empire included France, Germany, Italy. So this is where, you know, in this area, you already had a lot of Jews. Most of them would be cultured Jews already. And so he was able to bring these notables together. What did very much help is among the Jews, there was, did I bring it here? No, there was, we'll talk about him more, of David Sinsheim, which is a real, one of the Gedolim, happened to have been on the notables and on the Sanhedrin. And we'll see what he did. So it did help having such a figure there. Because if it was all modern and all, like, who knows what they would have come up with. And we're going to see that in other countries, in fact, it's going to be disastrous for the Jewish people, because there wasn't a Sinsheim, and there were people, in fact, looking to undermine the Jewish religion. So he then goes ahead with the notables. He asked them, we mentioned about 14 questions he asked them. They gave answers. He liked the answers. He said, let's make a Sanhedrin. Take those answers, and we're going to give like a religious, you know, backing to it, and it's going to have a stamp of this is what the Jewish people, this is what the rabbis have and want. And he believed that all the Jews would follow this Sanhedrin. And that's what he did.
What was 110
numbers? 110, he first did 110 notables.
Okay.
And he gave them the questions, and he said, discuss them. So they discussed them, and they came up with, you missed this, but the questions were very, very light.
The notables were elected by prefects, meaning by French people?
Yeah, they were brought in by different areas. So I don't know if they were elected, or they, you know, if you knew of somebody and had protection, you knew some guy, you know, could I get in?
Okay.
You know, but they were selected by government, like mayors from different areas.
Were they religious, or were they like
most of them, many of them were, many of them were not. Right, it was the beginning of Haskalah. Many of them were Maskilim. Overall, still at that time, most Jews were religious,
right,
to whatever degree. It's not going to be now already. It's going to be starting the reform and okay. So and
yeah,
okay,
yeah,
here's yes.
It's kind of interesting because we our whole focus is on this aspect of his leadership. But for him, it was a splinter of a splinter.
100%.
It was maybe very important to him.
Right.
Everything he did was important.
Right, right. He did so many things.
But he was doing a zillion things,
and each one was better than the next. I mean,
right,
the fact that he established the Bank of France,
right,
just in with the economy.
He was just
and he made an entire civil code for the entire country. While he was fighting off six coalitions of taking on the entire world.
Right.
Yeah, this was, you know, beautifying Paris, doing all these unbelievable things. This is one of many amazing accomplishments.
It's like Trump comes by and he stops at the Shul of Al Harbor.
Right,
but
right,
he's
right.
Off
right, right,
place.
Right. Right, you could make that. I think there is a comparison to make. To like say what Trump did, you know, and all these crazy things. That small thing he did this too. Yeah, and he moved the embassy, you know, also to Yerushalayim. And he made three peace treaties between Israel and three Arab nations, you know, among all of his other things.
Okay.
So Napoleon's reaction. Okay, so again, so he hears he gets the answers. He's very happy with the answers. He happened to have been in Posen at the time, which is, you know, on one of his battles and wars. And I think this is the fourth coalition, the third coalition, probably the third coalition. And he goes ahead, and where in Posen he delivers the results of that he had of the Sanhedrin. Okay, so what does he do now? He tells the Sanhedrin to go again to, for another 2-3 months, take your answers, take everything that you came and fine tune it, make it like real, like professional, real, very exacting. And then he went ahead and he made Jewish religion the third religion. Of course, Catholicism being Christian is number one. The Protestantism was two. I'm not sure Protestantism, Lutheranism, and all these other isms. I have no idea.
Yeah.
Pretty much the same. I don't know if they were all bundled in number two. I don't know if they were all bundled in number two, or some were in, some were out. I don't know. But Judaism, Judaism became the third official religion.
That's incredible.
Based on this, starting from 1807, and by 1811, it's going to make it into the Almanac of France. Okay, for March 17, 1808. So now that he had his answers, he makes three decrees for the Jewish people. There are going to be three. This is now his policy, how he is going to help the Jews make it into the modern era. And what's the first thing is he's taking the Jewish religion, he's putting it under the government. But he already did this for the Christian religion. The Christian religion, he took all the with the revolution, the Christianity was out. They closed down all the churches and nothing was doing. And he said, no, we're bringing you back in. But you're bringing you back in, you're now under the government.
Now we're in charge.
Okay, now, right. Now, again, didn't seem like he was interested in changing the day by day in the church thing. It's just, we're paying the salaries of the church, the government decided we're paying the priests and all the salaries of the church that was taken over by Napoleon, and the lands and the policies of the government. See, they weren't looking, it didn't seem, again, I'm not I'm not into the Christian religion, so somebody would get up, he says, no, he did interfere, and did this and this, I don't know. But it seems that he was just interested in just making sure that the church and the religion, Christian religion, was working well. And therefore, he could have a say in it, and he could make sure things were going well. He did that also for Protestantism, because that was the big, in the 1600s, that was the big machlokas, the 30 Years' War, and we discussed that, and there was a minority of people that were Protestants, and Lutherans, all they're very similar. They're not Christians. And that was the second religion. And the third is going to be Judaism, and he's going to do the same thing. So one of the things he's going to put them under, he's going to make what they call consistories. Now, consistories, again, this is the government is setting up a department for the Jewish religion, and there's going to be consistories. And ultimately, the government is going to make sure that everything is working well. I guess you also want to make sure that they don't become too radical. You know, I wonder if there would be consistories today in France, and you put the Muslim religion in France under the consistory, they wouldn't have their problems that they're having with the Muslims today. Mm. You know, I'm just like, I could imagine that's a purpose, that could be a purpose of what the consistories were. Okay, so what happened? The consistories consisted of a great rabbi and another rabbi, maybe three lay leaders of the town, and the consistories did a few jobs. Well, one of the jobs is to enforce the Sanhedrin rules. Again, the Sanhedrin came up with rules. This is what we expect from the Jews, and this is what we expect from the shuls and everything. And this is this education. You know, this is what we're going to educate the people as to this is what we expect. And they're also going to tell the government, and this is what the Jews are doing, you know, so this way the government's making sure that everything is going well. There was one consistory for every town that had contained 2,000 or more Jews. Rav David Sinzain, the Yad David, was the first rabbi. It was a bright spot on everything. He was appointed to lead the main consistory in Paris, okay, which had over 2,000. I guess it could be that that was the main consistory, and all the other consistories had to answer to that consistory. Keep in mind, I don't even know if there were 40,000 Jews and how many towns that they were in. So if there were, you know, it could be if there were 40,000, 2,000 in every town, there were only 20 consistories. You know, it could be when you had smaller towns, so they it could be you were part of a bigger town. I'm not sure, but that's how he broke it up. Every town over 2,000 had a consistory. Maybe there were 10, 15, 20, depends on how they broke up the Jews.
Was Rabbi Simon Orthodox?
Yeah, oh, he was a Gadol Hador.
Oh, well, really?
I remember having a shiur from his sefer. I think my Rosh Shiva quoted the Yad David in a shiur one time, which was his sefer. So he was really, really big. He was a tremendous Talmud Chacham. And well, I have more about him at the end. Okay, so you see here, everything is going to be nice because the consistory is run by Rav David Sinzain. I'm going to show you either next week or the week after when it was run by Isaac Jacobson, who is the father of the Reform movement. They actually is going to use these consistories to destroy Judaism. Okay? Right.
Yes.
Huh? Right. So that's the danger of putting the religion under a government. So in France, when you had a very liberal government, and they don't necessarily care, so then you're okay. If you have a religious government or a somebody, or even let's say a secular, let's say Israeli government that is a constant problem, an issue, which if we can get to it, I may have something on the bringing it forward to.
So it's also been the mechanism for collection of taxes, right?
Yes, it was. Could have been their way of the consistories could.
If I recall, chief rabbis, those were political positions in Europe.
Okay.
That's what
I'm not sure about taxes, but yes, it was that the consistories, the Jewish people had to pay the rabbi's salaries. Unlike the Christian religion, that was paid by the French government. The Jews, the rabbis were not paid by the French government.
That's
paid
good.
From the Jewish community. Right. We look at it in certain respects,
right.
Very good. But, it, you know, okay. But
Rabbi, it's kind of interesting because you have at least from my simple understanding, the unique blend of socialism and democracy combined.
Right,
here.
Right. And you could throw in dictatorship
because
he was an emperor. He voted himself in as emperor for life, and he was using the democratic, you know, revolution principles to
Well, he's the one. He's the enforcer. Of
right.
Was
right.
There a parliament?
There was no parliament. No.
Right, so there's nobody elected in France at this point.
Oh well, he set up an election system of mayors and governors.
Right.
But he was in charge of everything. He was the first, he was, right. Yeah.
You know, with this system that he created, he basically removed any potential enemy to him.
Okay.
You know, so
could
basically
be.
He find a way
to
keep everyone happy, but he
correct.
Will be then the boss.
He is up in charge of everything, and he has his right men. He has your reporting to, right, or... Like you're saying, also they could be upset with the consistory, but not upset with him,
exactly.
Right? He could remove himself. I agree.
By the way, Rabbi, I think, and I don't recommend anyone go see it because it looks too violent. But
I
think the movie's out right now.
Okay.
I know.
Right, well. Okay.
I saw a preview of it. It was too scary to watch the preview.
Okay. So
don't go watch it.
Second decree. So what also was happening is that the Jews were buying their way out of going to the army. In other words, let's say you had the guy next door and he had like, you know, 6, 7 Bulban kids, you know. So you pay them, look, you know, we had to send a kid, how about we'll pay you to send your kid to the army for us. And that was acceptable. Other non-Jews were able to do it. And it was something, it seemed that it was done. There wasn't a national draft up until the Reign of Terror. Before the Reign of Terror, there was no national draft, but I know, however they worked it out, they had to come in. Now, people were paying other people to go for them, and they said, even though other people are doing it, Jews, you can't do it. And that probably had to do with the complaint that the Jews were non-patriotic. You know, that they're within themselves. We know we need, you know, we have to show that the Jews are in fact patriotic. That was the second one. And then came the third one. Okay, the third decree. And that was called the restrictive decree. And basically the decree was, is that in order to get the Jews out of money lending, basically they said that all the Jewish debts were null and void. So besides being all null and void, but at least debts that were owed to Jews by married women, minors, soldiers, avoided, and any loan that interest exceeded 10%. Probably all loans exceeded 10%. I mean, I don't know how you can make money with less than 10%. So this was, you have to realize, many Jews are in the money lending business, and all of a sudden, all the money that you lent out, you cannot collect anymore. So you're having a bad day. This is not a, huh?
Thank you, Joe Biden.
Yeah. Okay. Right. 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 So this was again because, again, this was the complaint that he was having. He was also having a lot of with the Sanhedrin. He was having a lot of backlash from countries. We mentioned a few last week. A few countries, outside countries, were screaming at him. And we mentioned last week Russia and Alexander, Tsar Alexander, and many of these other countries were saying, how could you do this to the Jews? I have a few more, we'll see. But based on that backlash, he felt, again, he was a politician par excellence. So in order to appease his non-Jewish or anti-Semitic, you know, following or people, he threw this in as well.
And Russia wasn't his people, they were his enemies.
But I guess even, he was trying to court Russia before
he
invaded them.
So this was all about Alex, so he had to appease
them. Yeah, he had to appease them, and
like
Russia,
and
Germany, and Austria. He was, right, he was trying to keep Europe all together, and he did for a number of years. Russia fell out when they didn't go with the continental system. He was trying to isolate England, and like two or three countries were breaking the boycott on England. Portugal, I think it was Sweden or Norway, and Russia.
Russia's always been its own thing. They're like China. They've always been, don't mess with us.
So therefore, but again, at some point, he was trying to keep it all together. Yeah. Okay, so it was an attempt to get rid of the alleged usury by Jewish businessmen. Get into business or get into open up a store, a craftsman. They were peddlers mostly in interest. He wanted them to become farmers. Did not allow them to move to other parts of France unless they bought, you know, farmland and devoted themselves to agriculture and without entering into, it's like, you know, money lending, basically. That's really what he wanted from his Jews. Also one other thing, which is also very hard for the Jews, is that each Jew, to go into business, you also needed a license. You had to buy a license. Nobody else, none other sector of the society had to buy licenses to go into business. A few months later, he also added to this that he wanted the Jews to change their names to French names. That was a biggie also for them. The Jews had to have a fixed family name to help the government consistently keep track of all the Jews. They were restricted in their choice of names. They could not be allowed to pick names from the Hebrew Bible or their town names.
Mm.
You know, like, you know, like Alsace, you know. I'm trying to think about today we have
Paris.
Names. We have names of people from their own hometowns.
Yeah.
You know, I'm trying to think of it. Could you think of any names? I'm just drawing a blank. But many people have names that they come from certain towns, certain, you know, places.
Norman.
Berlin.
Berlin. Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Berlin.
Norman.
Norman.
Normandy.
Right.
Normandy.
I'm just trying to,
We had a professor, Jonathan Paris.
Yeah.
In Minnesota.
All right. So, but that's what they want. They didn't want, like, the shtetl names. You know, they wanted, you know, they wanted
the
real French names.
For the people or the cities?
Huh?
For their communities or for the people?
No,
for
each family had to have a French
that's
name.
That's big. That was one of the big three things that they tried to remove. Our clothing, our names.
Yeah. Okay, but yeah, you're right. So that's, you know, they felt if they had French names, again, they'll be more accepted in the French society. Again, this is the imperial decree in July of 2018, just the articles. Among our subjects who follow the Hebrew religion, they have to have fixed surnames and first names. And non-French Jews who come to live in the empire also have 3 months to get French names if you're moving into France. It can't be from the Old Testament, so now the names of towns expressly forbidden. And the reason is that now the consistories are asked to make a list of Jews so we can keep track of everything and everybody.
This is now something like anti-Semitism.
Well, you could say
us,
that. Right,
today,
right. Today it would be. In Germany, that's what Germany did to know where the Jews were. Back then it was more like, you know, we want, you know, you're a Frenchman like everybody else. We want to know how many are in the Jewish religion, how many are, you know, you're a part of our society. We have to know who you are and how many are. Like today, the census, you could check off if you're Jewish or not, but you know, they want to know. The census is want to know based on, you know, how much money they're spending and what they're... what
demographics.
Their demographics, and it's good for business to know what type of, you could say that it's for these other reasons as well to know. Jews, if they don't follow this, they could be expelled from the territories of the empire. The judge, minister of justice, our charges are concerned with the execution of the present decree. Okay, also he put an expiration date on the decree. It was a 10-year expiration. He says 10 years, they're expired unless we choose to renew it. And the idea Napoleon thought, and really correctly so, is that after 10 years, Jews will be like everybody else. We'll be fully integrated. We won't need special things for Jews in order to get them to become part of the society. If then they want to go into money lendering, so let them go. If they want to
change
their names or whatever, they wouldn't. In 1818, when they did expire, he was already out in 1814, 1815 was Waterloo. He was already exiled, so he didn't even last 10 years later. 10 years later, when King Louis the 16th, who is the brother of Louis the 14th, opted to renew the decree, he was known as the liberator. Huh? No, in
1818.
I'm sorry. 18 as opposed to Louis the 16th. Louis the 18th
was
as opposed to.
Before the revolution?
He was the
yeah.
one
then
who was killed. They
yeah.
chopped off his head. Him and Marie Antoinette.
So I have to go study that. They came again after Napoleon?
Yeah. No. After Napoleon lost and they got rid of him, they wanted to go back to royal. All the other countries, they didn't want revolutions of new, you know, democracy.
All the other kings wanted to go
back to monarchs. So let's put the monarch back on the throne of France as well.
So how did they get rid of them the next time again?
Huh? They didn't. But I mean, France was
different.
It's very hard to put the cat back in the bag when this was, you know, when it all came. So a lot of these laws were already in. You had a monarch, they try to undo a lot as much as they could, but you couldn't. A lot of things people were now used to, and they had about 10 years of these new changes. This was Napoleon's uncle, Cardinal Fesch, when he told the, this is his response to Napoleon. Sire, so you wish to end the world to come with your laws to give the Jews equality like the Catholics. Do you not know that the Holy Scriptures predict that at the end of the world, that the end of the world will happen when the Jews will be recognized as a corporate nation?
Wow.
That's what his uncle, this is a
cardinal, like
was saying to Marshal Kellerman, supported by mobilized opposition to Napoleon. So this is within France, recommended strongly that the Jews be prohibited from dealing in commerce. The emperor replied firmly and strongly, we must prevail in encouraging the Jews, who are only a very small minority amongst us. In the East departments, we find a great number of Jews that are very honest and industrious.
Is that first paragraph praising Jews?
No, I don't think so. It's a warning. He's saying, you want the world to end? I mean, the scriptures say when the Jews, you know, when you Jews are on top, that's it. Their Mashiach or whatever is going to come.
So
what are you ending the world for? He said, no, don't do it.
Wait,
huh?
They don't want Mashiach?
No.
Their
Mashiach came already.
Is that we're in charge?
Does that'll make one Mashiach too many.
I think he's coming back. That term corporate nation, I had a guy in my car a couple days back that was spewing all kinds of these weird theories. One of them was about we're all corporations, not citizens.
Okay, so I'm not sure what they meant. Now I'm not even sure what he meant there.
Next,
because of the tremendous amount of criticism Napoleon was receiving, he added, this is one of the reasons why he made this restrictive decree, the third one with the money. On the 17th of March, the decree, now so later, the decree limited the freedom given to Jews, claim was to reduce criticism to a manageable level, and gradually over time to remove the strict restrictions one by one. You know, okay, now you see, I all the restrictions, okay, so leave me alone. I restricted the Jews. You happy now? And then la'at la'at, slowly by slowly, was going to get rid of those restrictions. On the 11th of April, about a month later, Napoleon received a special audience with Mr. Furtado. Now, Mr. Furtado, if you remember, he was the one that led the notables. He was the number one. He was also, I didn't mention last time, I found that he was the first one to coin the term Orthodox Jew.
Really?
Yeah. So today we're called Orthodox Jews. Those that are following the halacha are called Orthodox Jews. Orthodox, means, I don't know if in Latin or Greek, it means correct. It means the right, the correct.
Ortho.
Right. So
orthodontist, orthopedics, ortho means straight.
Straight.
The ones that
the ones that are straight, the ones that are correct. And he's the one that the religious Jews, they're called the
Orthos.
So they had an audience to express their emotions of the co-religionists about the restrictive decree. After hearing them out, he immediately ordered 13 departments, including these, La Medina, the Southwest, Las Fastas, to eliminate the decree. In June of that same year, others, the Lower Pyrenees, also ordered data. Therefore, within 3 months of this restrictive decree, more than half of the departments involved were able to reinstate liberty and extend to their Jewish citizens. The last holdout was Alsace, where like 30,000 Jews were. That's where all the Jews were, and they were in Alsace. This province eventually removed their restrictions. Therefore, in 1811, all restrictions were removed, and nothing from a political or civil activity distinguished Jews from non-Jews in France. They had full rights in France under Germany. This is an anecdote. This is a story that's brought back by a soldier of his by the name of David Bloom. He shows how Napoleon was sympathetic to his grognards. So these are his soldiers. A young member of the army served with exceptional bravery. He was from Alsace. The emperor decided to decorate him with a medal in front of his troops. The emperor said, David Bloom, you are a brave soldier. Your place is with the old guard. Your place with the old guard is inevitable. The old guard was his special, like, you know, group of soldiers that was the best of the best. Then he took off his own silver medal, which he wore proudly, and pinned it on David Bloom's uniform. David Bloom responded by saying, Sire, I am from Alsace, and I find it difficult to accept this decoration as long as my family is being dishonored by French laws that limit their equality and freedom. I don't know how he had the guts to say that to Napoleon when Napoleon is honoring him, but Napoleon was visibly upset and reported to have said, they have lied to me again. I will correct these unfair restrictions immediately.
Who's they?
Wow.
Who's they?
I don't know who they is, and it doesn't say what year this is. Was this before 1811? Was this after 1811? I don't know. But that's the way the story goes. Okay, due to the close collaboration between the administrations, the rabbis and leaders of the Jews were able to leave the ghettos, participate freely in the life of France. They were able to enroll in universities, participate in whatever profession they wanted, work for various government agencies. Nothing was prohibited anymore. The Imperial Almanac of 1811 reported that the Jewish religion was now one of three religions accepted by the French government. It was not only in France, but in all the countries where France ruled, which was basically all of Europe, because at that time they had, till Russia, all the way through Spain, up to Portugal, was all under French's control. But in other countries, the new civil code which Napoleon created assured liberty, fraternity, and equality for all people, regardless of their religion, station in life. So he came up with a civil code, but it wasn't automatically applied to Jews. Once it was applied to Jews, that's it, and his civil code made it to other countries as well. This is huge. I don't remember where I saw it. I mean, I copied it from you. But I think in 1811, thanks to Napoleon's efforts, Portugal. Now, Portugal was never under Napoleon. The French never conquered Portugal. They had Spain. They put one of his siblings was the king of Spain for a short time, but they never had control of Portugal, the Napoleon. But in Portugal, allowed Jews complete freedom in 1811. Their Inquisition was over, and permitted them to open up their synagogues that were closed for over 200 years.
Wow.
I mean, for 200 years, they were all Anusim. Moranos, however you wanted to call them, that was it. There was no openly Jewish,
right.
You know, and I guess whatever was still had with the Jews, they allowed them. Okay, Jews, you want to become Jews or openly Jews could, but that was huge, huge. Portugal not under Napoleon because it was already allowed in Napoleon, so they started to allow it in other countries. Napoleon brought this to the Netherlands, to West Germany, and to the and Italy. These were all directly under France. And where he went, where this went, to the Jews had gained freedom. Next week, we're gonna talk about the Netherlands. We're actually gonna talk about Holland, right, Denmark, the Netherlands. We're gonna talk about, because what's gonna happen there is under the Batavian Republic is going to, the Jews are gonna split. The modern Jews, they're going to start their own community. And then the consistory is going to come and put them back in its place. Whereas in Germany, the opposite is going to happen. Jerome Bonaparte is going to be the king of Westphalia. He's going to make, and we're going to see also what he did and how that affected Jews there. So this is now going to affect Jews in all countries. Italy, well, we're going to see what Italy very soon. It brought equality before the law, end oppressive taxation, enforced residential restrictions, and the opportunity to participate as free men in public and political life in Italy, Germany, and Netherlands. Would you imagine? This is like, you know, Mashiach is coming. What? Yeah, really? Well, in those parts of Spain which French authority did not reach, the Inquisition continued to function. Again, you know, no Jews, just if you follow the Jews, and we'll kill you. They didn't learn their lesson. But they never really had a good hold on Spain. And he lost tens of thousands of soldiers, and over 100,000 soldiers in Spain. It was one of his losing things of Spain. Okay, Napoleon finally gets defeated. He's defeated in, not Waterloo, he's defeated at the Battle of, can't remember the name, and he's taken away and he's put on some island, he's St. Alba, I think it was. He escapes from the island, comes back to France, and instead of the French army arresting him, the French army follows him. And he has another battle, and this leads to the Seventh Coalition, And finally, they had enough, and they put him on a different island, either that was St. Elmo or some island that's in the middle of right off Africa, where he died of stomach cancer on that island.
Who caught him and put him on the island?
The Seventh Coalition. The Sixth Coalition put him on the first island. And
so
then
this was France rebelling against him?
Not France. The world rebelling against him.
Who was
for the seventh time.
Who are we calling the coalition?
Russia, England.
Oh, those are the enemy.
You know,
enemy.
Russia, Germany. Okay, so the Congress of Vienna, after Waterloo, probably in 1815, at the time the laws permitting equality, liberty, and fraternity was retracted. So anything that, that Napoleon did was undone. It's possible, no good, terrible. So that's it. All your freedom stuff is out the window.
Wow.
It was not applied again until 1830, when the principles fixed by the revolution came back. You know, it's like something that you couldn't really go back to the way it was. People were now used to it, had a different understanding of what freedom is, how a person should live, and it's a movement, it's a frame of mind, and it's not going to go back. Temporarily, they held it down, but it wasn't. Prussia. Now, what are all these countries going to do about the Jews that had their freedom till 1814, 1813? For like 6-7 years in there, you know, what are they going to do to the Jews? So they're going to take it out on the Jews. Prussia retracted the liberal laws in 1815 after the Battle of Waterloo. The worst setback was inflicted on the Jews of the Papal States. Pius VII, taking revenge on the Jewish population, threw them back into the ghettos, made them wear the yellow badge again. Mm. Sardinia, the Jews were again thrown into ghettos and not allowed to build the shul.
What's Prussia? It looks like
Prussia is Eastern
Germany,
Eastern Germany.
But they had taken that much of Italy?
They'd taken Poland also. Prussia, Austria, and Russia divided up Poland among
and
the
a
three.
Lot of Italy there. Looks like half of Italy.
Where?
I mean, that whole, you know, that
I'm trying
that
to figure
whole
out.
Hand.
This is Italy. This
so
is
that whole
Prussia.
Northern part.
Prussia is over here. Austria may have taken a lot of it. Now, Prussia would be up here.
Europe's been a mess for years.
Yeah. Okay. Other European nations. Holland did not allow anything for Jews until 1830. Sweden, 1834. Switzerland, 1838. We may get into later. England. It was only after, in 1858, after Lord Lionel Rothschild, however you say his name, was elected 5 times, that he was permitted to take a seat in the parliament. You know, he was elected, I guess by Jews or wherever he was, but they did not, he was a Jew, they didn't elect, they didn't allow him to take a seat until the 5th time, all right, you could sit down with him. He was permitted to take a seat in the parliament. Also interesting to note that the laws that were passed in France in 1808 are still in existence even today. Okay, I have just 2 things I wanted to show you. One is, in the Sefer Minchas Oni, I guess, this, I'm not familiar with the Sefer, but this was written by David Sinsheim. Mm. So he had to live in France, he had to live in Paris. He was originally from Strasbourg, he was the chief rabbi of that area, but he moved to Paris because he was now in charge of the consistories. So he found himself in Paris and he had to do his learning. He writes in the preface of his Sefer, he writes, I call the name of this work Minchas Oni, the gift of the sacrifice of the impoverished, for I composed this in the midst of impoverishment of Torah. Here in the city of Paris, I was lacking in the necessary svarim, as well as sufficient time to properly study. This was because of the necessity of my involvement in addressing the needs of the community. Despite all of this, I didn't neglect my studies, for even an instant, preface to the Sefer Minchas Oni by Rav David Sinsheim. Mm. This is a eulogy given by, I think this is given by the Chassam Sofer. Chassam Sofer gave this eulogy. Now we all know who the Chassam Sofer is. The Gadol Hador, this is what he wrote about the Rav David Sinsheim. The tzaddik for whom we are gathered here to eulogize, Rav Agoyin Moreno Rav David Sinsheim of blessed memory, the author of the Sefer Yad David, despite the fact that he was very respected and close to the members of the French government in Paris and held in high esteem by the Emperor Napoleon, nonetheless spent his entire life devoted to the study of Torah. getting extraordinary expertise in all the works of the Rishonim, as well as the Achronim, to recognize his greatness. While I was yet a youth, and even more recently as I exchanged letters with him, I wouldn't be surprised if Rav David Sinsheim was talking with Chassam Sofer, what about this issue, what about that issue, what do I tell them about all these questions, the government. They weren't able to, I beheld his saintliness and perfection, they weren't able to prevail over him and to tempt him to follow them. On the contrary, I guess he's talking about the non-religious Jews. Right after he revealed to them one tefach, a hand's breadth, he covered over two tefachim. It's an expression. He compromised on insignificant issues and preserved that which was essential. His perfection remained intact, and his spirit, none of its vigor. So you see how he talks about him. Now, also, what's going to happen is, with everything that the Sanhedrin wrote, you have to realize all of the maskilim are going to take what they wrote and they're going to say, look what they wrote, and therefore this must be permitted. So Rav David Sinsheim is very careful how they worded things so it should not be taken out of context by other Jews that are not following, that are not like, that want to change things. The encounter of Jewish people with Napoleon was a turning point in Jewish history. First time a modern statesman had envisioned the Jewish problem as a fundamental issue of international politics. Napoleon did more than any other leader prior to his time to give security and religious freedom to the Jews and nations under his control. He had little in the way of political motivation for his policy. There were no more than 40,000 Jews living in France, and there were 21 or 29 million Jews. I mean, 40,000 is like a 0.03%. of the population. It was just like nothing. One or two other, and the Jews of France, the empire recognized that this was a reflection of his humanity. They were so thankful for him that they made a prayer. We have a prayer inserted in the prayer books in every shul under Napoleon's control. Mm-hmm. And the prayer was Hashem.
Napoleon.
Yeah, this is for Napoleon. It says Hashem should show Hashem in all the lands under his Memshala, in all the kingdoms, he's been ruling with Tzedek and Mishpat. He is a man that comes in peace. How fortunate is our lot that from your hand, from people, Adara, Al Rosh Ish Ibor Koyal, on this strong warrior, Rav Paul and Napoleon Hagado, to sit on the seat of France and Italy. Did you find such a man that has righteousness with him? And this is a
tefillah. It's their prayer for government.
Huh?
It's their prayer for
right.
Government.
It could be that he was changed, right, for, you know, different countries and different things.
Well,
but this is how they viewed him, such a righteous person, what he's done. And this is their, our.
The problem with that is that when you get the next government that's anti him, then we're looking upon it as.
Right, and that's exactly what happened to the Jews in the short term.
Yeah.
Once Napoleon was taken down, everything that he had wanted to do, that was undone. But fortunately, whatever, it's not something that could be totally undone.
Right.
Now, in the end of things, and I guess pretty much we're going to, you know, we're going to discuss things, everything here is going to have ramifications.
Yeah.
Okay? What Hashem did to the Jewish people is he pushed them, he threw them into the modern era, the 1900s, the modern era. Up until then, the Jews were happy. They were mostly living in shtetls. They were living all the way outside of everything. And that's how they had control. And they were all religious and they were all from, because they were all from it. There was nowhere else to go. That's the way it was. But now, they're going to be pushed in. They're going to have to deal with all these nations. We're going to see that even in the East, and all in Poland, when you have the millions of Jews, and Napoleon came across, the Rebbe's and many of the rebbes, most of the rebbes, most of the rabbis were, you know, the leaders of the Jews, sided with Alexander the Great, and he was a terrible anti-Semite. But they felt they would rather have his terrible decrees and remain religious rather than have the freedom of Napoleon and become Nazi. But this is coming east. And all these ideas and this, you know, everything, it's on their way. It's there. So next week, we're going to start with the Batavian Republic, what happened there, the modern Jews, what they did, and the reformers are going to copy, and they're going to see how the reformers are going to use this consistory in Germany to further their ends. Okay, and so that's going coming up, and that's now that's it. This is the start. This is Jews in the modern era, and okay, so. All right, thank you all for coming, and Yetz Hashem next week, Batavian Republic, and then if I may start with Isaac Jacobson, see how much we have on, and the Reform Movement.
Lights, Rabbi?
Lights.